Well, let's get into this, shall we? We're working our way through the second half of Mark's Gospel, and we've been considering, and we will be considering this in this second half, what does it mean to follow Jesus? We looked a few weeks ago that one of the core things about following Jesus is to listen to him. You've got to be able to hear him speak to know how to follow him. And tonight we come across one of the specifics of Jesus' teaching. We're looking tonight at that first chunk of chapter 10 there, Jesus' teaching on marriage, divorce, and remarriage. Now, this is a loaded topic, yeah? And there will be a number of you tonight who find this teaching just hard to listen to. And you'll find it hard to hear because even just the simple mention of the word divorce, there's a reaction going on in you. There's a lot of personal pain maybe for you about this issue. And with divorce rates being what they are in our country at the moment, around 40%, depending on which statistic you look at, chances are it's unlikely that there's actually a person in the room here tonight that hasn't been affected by divorce in some way. Whether it's your own parents or whether it's your immediate family, someone in your family, or where it's a good close friend, or whether it's just you yourself have been through a divorce. Most of us, I'd say all of us, have been affected in some way. Some of you personally affected so much so that we just went through Valentine's Day this week and you found yourself scoffing at everybody expressing their love to each other because for you, it's a painful day because of what you've been through. And because of the pain that can come up just at the mention of this topic, it can be hard to listen to the words of Jesus with an objective framework. Yeah. So I'm going to pray, and I'm going to pray and ask God for help that we would hear his words despite the pain and complexity that we might be experiencing in our lives. Yeah, you pray with me? Father God, give us ears to hear your word to us. Please soften our hearts so we can receive it. We need help and healing in our brokenness. Please guide us into the truth for Jesus' name's sake. Amen. Amen. This is not just a painful topic, but it's also a very tricky and complex topic. And you can see how complex it is by the context of the passage that we're looking at here tonight. Have a look there, and we'll read the first few verses. Jesus then left that place and went into the region of Judea across the Jordan. Again, crowds of people came to him, and as was his custom, he taught them. Some Pharisees came and tested him by asking, "Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife?" So the Pharisees come to Jesus with a simple question, and you actually get it unpacked a little bit more in Matthew, "Is it okay to divorce?" And Matthew gives a little bit more detail. Is it okay to divorce for any and every reason? But the Pharisees are not just coming with a question that's a simple question that's got a simple answer. Why are they bringing this question to Jesus? What are they trying to do? Verse 2, some Pharisees came and tested him. So you see what the Pharisees are doing? They're wanting to test Jesus. They're wanting to trick him. They're wanting to catch him out and show him to be a little bit foolish. So they come to him with a question that is far from simple, with a really simple answer. They come to him with a really tricky one that doesn't have a straightforward answer. So the very context here tells us this has been tricky for centuries. It isn't a simple question. It is a simple question somewhat, but it doesn't have a really simple, straightforward answer. In fact, this is a minefield, this world that we're stepping into tonight. The other thing worth noticing here is they bring Jesus this question just as Jesus enters the region of, what does it say, Judea. Now, this is the region where John the Baptist, being involved in discussing this very topic, was executed and had his head removed. Not sure if you know that, but back in chapter 6, you get the record of John the Baptist who actually speaks his mind on this issue of divorce and remarriage to King Herod, and for expressing the teaching that he believes to be true, was executed for it. So this really is a minefield, and people have felt heated about this subject for centuries. So here's how I'm feeling. If I can get out of here tonight with my head still attached. That's a win for me, all right? I'm honestly feeling quite nervous about going here because I know it is so tricky. And so here's a little disclaimer. I'm going to try to tread carefully. I don't have the answers. We're not going to sort this out in a flash. It's impossible for me to cover every situation that any person could find themselves in and give all the possible scenarios for what might be right or wrong. Here's what I want to do. I want to look at the teaching of Jesus and some of the other teachings in the Bible and try to put forward what I think is relatively clear about the subject, right? Then I want to try to acknowledge a whole bunch of complexities that we live in, try and apply that teaching. Then I want to arrive at looking at the goodness of God in the midst of all of this. So that's what we're going to attempt to do tonight, all right? Let's start. Look at verses 3 through to 5. Actually, we'll read from verse 2. Some Pharisees came and tested him by asking, "Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife?" "What did Moses command you?" Jesus replied. They said, "Moses permitted a man to write a certificate of divorce and send her away." And then Jesus replies, "It was because of your heart, because your hearts were hard that Moses wrote you this law." Now, I'll just pause there for a minute. The Pharisees, the ones who are bringing this question to Jesus, are experts in the law of Moses. So they know what it says. But unfortunately, they've been using their expertise in the law instead of upholding the law. What they've been attempting to do, and particularly upholding the very heart of the law, what the Pharisees often do is use their expertise to kind of nitpick and look at the fine print and actually look for loopholes in the law and try to get around it. This is God's thing. We need to hear from him on it. We didn't invent it, so we can't mess with it. God came up with the idea of marriage. It tells us, secondly, here's the second thing it tells us about marriage. It is, what does it say? At the beginning of creation, God made them male and female. We live in a society that's trying to water down any differences between gender, but the Bible would apparently see gender as a very real thing that God created in the beginning, very core to society and a fundamental part of marriage. God made man and woman, and he made them to be brought together into this relationship called marriage and to express that they were in that relationship through this one flesh relationship, which you might call the comprehensive union that has the potential to produce offspring because they were commanded to be fruitful and multiply. It's all part of the created order. Be fruitful and multiply for the sake of family and society. This is God implanting marriage right in the created order. The third thing you see, which is really clear, is this. The two will become one flesh, so they are no longer two but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let no one separate. Okay? So there's the big point. If God pulls two people together, don't let that be separated. Marriage is to be a lifelong commitment, a lifelong union. Do not divorce is what's implicit in that. Do not separate. And don't you be someone who gets in the way of someone else's marriage and breaking that up. Marriage is for life, which is why we have vows when we have our marriage ceremonies. Well, some of us have these vows, which is till death do us part. These days, 80% of people get married with a civil celebrant, and a lot of those make up their own vows, so they miss out on this one. But if you get married with the traditional vows, you'll say, till death do us part, which is to say, I'm in this till I die or you die. This is lifelong commitment. It's not till I fall out of love with you. It's not till we grow apart. It's not until even you hurt me badly. I'm in this till I'm dead or you're dead. And that's the foundation that we've got here. And we want to start with the foundation. Marriage is between a man and a woman. Marriage is for life. Don't divorce. There's the foundation. Now, if that's the foundation, why then does there appear to be a level of permission to divorce? If the original command and intent is don't divorce, there does appear to be permission there. And that's why the Pharisees bring it. Look, they say, Moses permitted a man to write a certificate of divorce and send her away. Well, how can that be the case? Look at Jesus' response. It is because your hearts were hard. Which is Jesus saying, This is not part of the original intent. This is because there's a flaw in you guys. Your hearts were hard. And so this is not an ideal thing. This is almost an unfortunate concession that needed to be made because there's a problem with humanity, unable to relate well. Heart hard is literally meaning rebellious towards God, more generally meaning we're broken, we're sinful, our relationships, including our marriages, get messy and they don't stay together. It's not as simple as saying, well, Moses permitted divorce under certain circumstances, so it's fine. It's an unfortunate concession that needed to be given, and Jesus says it was given because your hearts were hard. Now, come back with me to the place where you originally see that, and then we'll be back in Mark. So keep something there in Mark. Come back to Deuteronomy chapter 24, which I've got to say is not simple. There's lots of ifs and buts in this passage, and we're not going to sort out all the complexities here, but I do want to notice one big thing about this passage. So Deuteronomy chapter 24, which is what's being referred to here by the Pharisees. It's confusing, but there is something I think that's clear to get from it. Deuteronomy 24, verse 1, if a man marries a woman who becomes displeasing to him because he finds something indecent about her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce, gives it to her and sends her from his house. Just pause there for a minute. Is that an instruction that it's a good thing to do? Is that like saying this is... It doesn't say that he did the right thing, giving her a certificate of divorce. It just says that he did it. It's just acknowledging that it happens. And Jesus says, it happens. People are divorcing and sending each other away, sometimes for very poor reasons, because your hearts are hard. So that's the first thing to notice. This is far less about permission for divorce under certain circumstances. It just states that it's happening. The teaching comes further down in this passage, verses 3 and particularly verse 4, because the teaching is, look, if this happens, verse 2, and if after she leaves his house she becomes the wife of another man and the second husband dislikes her and writes her a certificate of divorce. Now, it just sounds archaic, doesn't it? I don't like my wife, I'm going to send her away to someone else. There's a problem with what's happening here, but it's also likely that when the husband's finding something displeasing to her, that's connected with the word indecent in verse 1, yeah? Which is likely that she's committed some type of sexual sin, some type of sexual immorality. Likely. That's what a lot of people think. So it might be that there was good reason for the marriage to have been broken. But the thing is, she goes from that marriage into another marriage. She marries again, but then the same thing happens in that marriage. And she moves from that marriage. Then verse 4, then her husband, who divorced her, is not allowed to marry her again after she has been defiled. Now, this is crazy stuff here. We're not going to be able to answer all the questions. But the word defiled simply meaning she's done the wrong thing here. So for the original husband to come back and marry her again would be the wrong thing to do. Why? Because of the second marriage. Because she shouldn't have gone and got married again. So really the command is not, well, the instruction is not under what conditions is it okay to get divorced. It's more focusing in on, for this woman here to have been divorced, she shouldn't have married again. Now, there's lots of people who kind of think lots of things about why that's the case. I think it's likely the case that she's not to marry again because she has been the party in that relationship that has actually broken the marriage initially by committing some type of sexual immorality, some type of adultery. And in that case, she is not permitted to marry again because she was the one who broke it. She was the one who effectively initiated the divorce and stepped into it. Now, if that's what that is meaning, come back to Mark with me now. And there's plenty of people who don't think that's what that's meaning, but I'll tell you what, it's hard to figure out. Come back to Mark with me and look at verses 10 and 11 because I think this is unpacking the very same concept Jesus is talking about here. So when they were in the house again, the disciples asked Jesus about this. They're confused, okay? He answered, anyone who divorces his wife and marries another woman commits adultery against her. And then he says the same thing in the opposite way. And if she divorces her husband and marries another, she commits adultery. Now, if the word divorce here is being used to describe what the person who breaks the marriage is doing, So if a husband divorces his wife, if a husband is the one who effectively steps out of the marriage and effectively breaks the one flesh union by stepping into it with someone else, if the husband is the one who goes and commits adultery or sexual immorality, it's wrong for him to remarry. And then it just flips it and says the very same thing again. If it's the wife who actually breaks the marriage, if it's the wife who commits infidelity, if it's the wife who's been adulterous, she is not to remarry again. And that implies something, doesn't it? If that's what it's teaching, that does imply that the innocent party in a divorce, the one who was sinned against, is permitted to go and remarry after that divorce. Now, that implication, I think, is drawn out more explicitly in Matthew. So now come to Matthew's teaching with me, which is, you know, Matthew talking about the very same things. We'll do two spots in Matthew. Come to Matthew chapter 5, which is the Sermon on the Mount. Matthew chapter 5, verse 31. Look at Jesus says, "It has been said, anyone who divorces his wife must give her a certificate of divorce. But I tell you, anyone who divorces his wife, except for sexual immorality, makes her the victim of adultery, and anyone who marries a divorced woman commits adultery." But you see the exception clause in there? Anyone who divorces his wife except for sexual immorality. So you might say that's the valid grounds for divorce, when there's been sexual immorality. The Greek word is just porneia, and there's a lot of discussion about how broadly that concept can be applied. Come to Matthew chapter 19, where you get a very similar thing again. Matthew 19, which is the parallel account of the one in Mark that we're looking at. Verse 8, chapter 19. Jesus replied, "Moses permitted you to divorce your wives because your hearts were hard, but it was not that way from the beginning. I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife, except for sexual immorality, and marries another woman, commits adultery." Can you see what's being described here? It's not obviously easily clear, but I believe it's this. The innocent party who has not wronged and divorced in the marriage is free to remarry. It's wrong to remarry except for sexual immorality, meaning the valid grounds is if your spouse has been adulterous and they're the ones that have left the one flesh relationship and broken the marriage, you, the innocent one, are actually free to sign the forms and make official what's effectively already happened and get out of that marriage and remarry. And I think 1 Corinthians chapter 7 would talk about that concept as well, is that that person is no longer bound to that original marriage. Now, of course, if you're the innocent party, you're not the one that's committed adultery, you don't have to actually make that divorce official. You can choose to attempt to forgive and attempt to restore, as I know a number of people have struggled to work out how to do, but you don't have to take them back. And if you are the one who's committed adultery, sexual immorality, just so you know, your spouse does not have to take you back. They are not obliged to do so. Now, can I humbly suggest there's the broad brushstrokes, if I'm reading it right. And there's a lot of people who would disagree because the teaching is quite tricky. But I think the broad brushstrokes are clear-ish. And I could summarize it by saying this. Marriage is for life. If you're married, stay married, don't divorce. The only valid grounds for divorce would be is if your spouse commits sexual immorality. And if that's the case, then you may not be at fault and you therefore are free to divorce and remarry. Number three, if you're the one who does the divorcing, if you're the one who breaks the marriage and is adulterous and you effectively leave that one flesh relationship, you are not to remarry. I think that's the broad brushstrokes of the teaching. And I'm super aware of how controversial that is to say in our society. In fact, it always has been. Now, that might sound relatively straightforward, but there's nothing straightforward about applying that to our world with the hundreds of complexities that we live with and the thousands of different situations that we might find ourselves in. And let me suggest some of the complexities that come when we try to consider applying that teaching. Here's the first complexity. The concept of the exception clause being sexual immorality, that word porneia, how broadly does that term, is it okay to apply that term? Like, what does that cover? Now, most people agree that it obviously or at least covers, you know, sex with another person that you're not married to, an adulterous affair. But does it cover other forms of sexual immorality as well? Things that might not technically be sex, but might come under the category of sexual immorality, other kind of behaviours. Is that grounds for divorce? Or what about lusting in your mind, pornography, which Jesus would say is adultery of the heart? Is that grounds for divorce? Because, geez, there'd be stacks of wives that would have grounds for divorce if that was the case. What about when your spouse goes and has a relationship with another person that's not physical and it's not sexual, but it's very deep and it's emotional, it's kind of like an affair? Is that unfaithfulness? Is that grounds for divorce? It's very complex. Some would say yes. What about if you're in a marriage where there's abuse happening? Physical abuse, sexual abuse, or even just verbal abuse? Now, wise counsel is pretty consistent in this regard. If that's the situation that you are in, you need to seek safety for yourself, and particularly if there's kids in that household. And the advice is usually to actually step out of that situation and separate at least for a time, which is going to keep you safe and get you out of a situation where you're being abused. And number two is actually quite a loving thing to do to your spouse if they are abusing you, because it gives them an opportunity to actually consider their sin. And then if they can understand their sin, get help. And then in time, and geez, you'd want to give it some time to see if there's actually any change going on. But if change can happen, then there's the opportunity for a restoration and it doesn't need to go to divorce. That's what I'd say in regards to abuse. And 1 Corinthians chapter 7 again would talk about an appropriate separation that can happen when marriages are just getting really messy and you can't work it out while you're still under the same roof. I'll give you another complexity. The complexity of identifying clearly the innocent person and the guilty party in a marriage breakup. Not so easy. There are some cases, though, I think. There are some cases where it's clear that there's an innocent party because someone else has committed a sexual sin and it's been done in, you know, it's pretty clear there's a guilty and an innocent, but often things are actually more complex than that. That's the reality of marriages. There's two sides to every story, and it's actually impossible for anybody to actually look into someone else's marriage and to discover all the details of what's actually occurred behind closed doors. It's impossible to see that, and I take my hat off to marriage counsellors who attempt to, but it's impossible to see what's gone on. And I'll give you a couple of examples of how it can be complex in that way. The husband who goes and has an adulterous affair with his secretary from work. That sounds kind of clear cut, doesn't it? The assumption would be that the wife is innocent. Until you discover what's been happening for years, and you discover that she has been verbally abusing him and emotionally abusing him and removed any physical affection or intimacy or sexual intimacy from the relationship, so much so that it's left him just an emasculated man, just kind of longing for any kind of connection and affirmation that he ends up finding in his secretary. People would call that kind of scenario the man that's driven into the arms of another. Have you heard that saying? Sayings become sayings because there's some truth in them. Now, there is no excuse for adultery, yeah? So you don't want to make an excuse for that, but I simply want to acknowledge the complexity of what's actually going on in marriages. And there's always at least a level of fault from both directions. There's always a level of fault. I'll give you another scenario. The wife goes off and is unfaithful and has an affair. and they get divorced. And the husband remarries relatively quickly. And you might look at that from a distance and say, that's okay. That's fine. That's permitted. And then you discover that the woman he's married is actually his old girlfriend, and he's always stayed in touch with her and kept that relationship alive. And he's always secretly wished that he was married to her. And so he's subtly worked over the years to drive his first wife away from him. It's complex. Again, it doesn't never excuses adultery. There's no excuse for that. But we need to acknowledge the complexity of relationship. There's often a level of fault on both sides. Now, what about the wife in that situation who actually did commit adultery? She technically broke the marriage, so she shouldn't remarry, if that's your understanding of the teaching here. But now she moves in with a guy who she had the affair with, and she has a child with him. And so they've now got this blended family. Is it the case that it's still right that she should never be married? Because they're living as a married couple with kids involved. Can you still hold the line that they shouldn't be married? It may be the best thing for the kids that they actually do get married. Can you see how complex it is? This is the world we live in. And these are the scenarios that I and others are working in on a weekly and monthly basis, because this is the world we live in. If truth be told, all marriages have a level of offense happening in them. There's a sense in which when you come and live closely alongside another sinner, there's going to be hard things about that. There's going to be damage that you do to each other. Nobody loves and serves their spouse perfectly every day, every month, every year of their marriage. It doesn't happen. There is a level of pain and hurt in every marriage, because when you draw so close to someone else, you inevitably make yourself vulnerable to them. So when there is pain, it goes so much deeper. Sometimes it's hard to even know what you're doing wrong. And maybe you're there, maybe you're feeling like that at the moment. You're like, I've done something. I know I'm doing something wrong, but I've really got no idea what it is. I need her to explain it to me, or I need a third party to come in and sit down with us and explain what is going on, because I can't figure it out. Deb and I are going on being married almost 20 years now. And we've had multiple times throughout those... I hope you're okay for me to share this stuff. We've had multiple... I think you'll be right. We've had... Now, some of you look 20 years, you're like, oh, you're spring chickens. We've been married for 59 or whatever, right? That's cool. Good on you. That's awesome. But I'm feeling like 20 years is all right. I feel like we're getting there. What do you reckon, Dale? All right? For us, personally, to get to 20 years, we've had multiple times over the years where we've needed to just stop and actually acknowledge what's going on in our marriage and acknowledge that we've drifted towards living in a relationship where we're kind of fighting against each other, and we're beating up on each other with all lots of big and small and little and subtle things, and we're not living for each other like we should. And I tell you what, those moments where you stop and check and you see that, I tell you, they're really, really important moments. And they've been moments for us to actually go, okay, we need to soften our hearts towards each other and attempt again to love and serve like we should. And I tell you, there's been multiple moments for us. Big ones, small ones, and those of you who've been married for longer than us, I'm assuming that's been the same for you. Multiple, and I'm assuming for us to get to 40, 50 years married, there's going to be a lot more of that, where we sometimes can't even figure it out ourselves, but we get help, and we've had help. And most people will testify that sometimes you need help to figure out what on earth is going on in this marriage and why we can't figure things out. It's worth fighting for. It's worth getting help for. Make sure you do. Now, on this board, I can't help but to want to make a point to young couples. I had a page that's disappeared somehow. We'll be right. We'll get there. If you're young and, you know, you're already married, or you're thinking we will be married, or you're young enough in your marriage that there hasn't been many struggles yet, you might be thinking, we'll be fine, we're in love. And that might be the case. You might be the exception. You might be that 1 in 100 exception where there's really not a lot of conflict and not a lot of hardship, just love and good times the whole time. Most couples will testify that there will be a moment in their marriage, or at least a moment early on in their marriage, often where they look at each other or they just think in their hearts, oh no, I've married the wrong person. Yeah? Most married couples will, that's happened. Not you, but everyone else. That moment where you go, I thought I'd married the love of my life, my soulmate, my everything, and now they've turned into a monster, you know? I know I said for better and for worse, but I wasn't picturing this when I was picturing worse, you know? I was just thinking maybe he would fart in bed, maybe, but now he's treating me so badly. Or I thought she might just get upset sometimes. But she's growing claws and now I'm afraid to go home, you know? And it's not what you were picturing. Things can get really tough. Really tough. And it's actually easy to find yourself in a place where you're thinking, I want out. It's not what I signed up for. And there are very real reasons why we can be left feeling that way. It's because we're broken. A lot of us. And so the way we relate will be broken. And our marriages can be very hard to keep together. I want to attempt to apply this teaching to a number of different groups of people in different situations. And there's kind of the first one, young people. And actually, I'll get a little bit more for young people, if that's all right. Because as I've chatted to divorced people throughout the week and other people give me advice, the big thing people usually say is talk to the young people. Tell them what not to do. Tell them what to do. So here you go. Here's a little bit of a spray for the young people, particularly those of you who are not married yet and considering marriage. Marry very carefully because you can't get out of this one. Don't go in thinking, it doesn't work out, I'll get out. No, this is for life. You're effectively writing a blank check and presenting it to another person. And if you're too young to know what a blank check is, checks are these things that old people used to do, right? It's this paper, you'd sign it and write a number on it and you'd give it to a person. It was like money, right? But occasionally a person would write a blank check, meaning you'd sign the bottom, you'd hand it to the person, you'd say, you write the number and I'll honour whatever you write. Like, it's a scary thing, hand a blank check to a person, right? When you get married, you are handing a blank check to the person and you're saying, whatever you write on this, I'm going to honour it. However this goes down, I'm going to stick by you. That's a big commitment. That's huge. In fact, that's so big that when Jesus was teaching about this kind of commitment level, his disciples, you get it back in Matthew chapter 19, his disciples stopped and went, maybe marriage is not such a good idea. You know, that's what they literally say. You've got to be very careful before you step into it. And that is the case. You want to be careful. You want to, as best as you can, get an understanding of what you're going to be in for. Because you're in for something and you want to know what you're going to be in for. Now, you're never going to know for sure, but you want to get a good glimpse of what you're going to get yourself in for. Most people these days therefore think, well, we'll move in together before we get married and that'll be a tester. That's a shocking idea. The stats would say you're twice as likely to divorce if you live together before you're married. So just let the statistics rebuke you on that one if you're thinking that's a good idea. You can't test commitment, by the way. You either commit or you don't. Yeah, but you want to weigh it up before you dive in and get a glimpse of what you're going to be in for. And I think the best way to get a glimpse of what you're going to be in for is go out with the person for a good amount of time before you're getting married. Yeah, sometimes we've got a bit of a trend in this church and in other congregations as well. Is just people just meet in the hallway out there and they're like, "Do you want to get married? Okay, next week, let's do this." And on one level, it's like, yeah, whatever. You know, it doesn't matter who you marry; you're going to struggle. So yeah, marry them, whatever. But on another level, it's wise to know what you're going to get yourself in for. So go out with them for a while, date for a good amount of time, I think short engagements are fine, but you want to go out for a good amount of time. Deb and I went out for about 3.5 years. Not that I'm saying ours is the perfect thing, but you want to get a chance to get a glimpse of what you're in for. I've got another story. I hope you're okay with me telling this one, Deb. So Deb and I have been going out for about 2 years, right? I think that's kind of the point where the shine starts to come off. You think she thought I was this knight in shining armor, and then she started to see some chinks in my armor, and the shine wasn't there so much. And Deb had this moment where, and she told me about it. It was devastating for me. She said, I'm just not sure that I like you anymore. And I'm like, what? What's not to like about this? And that was what was not like about this, you know? I just like myself too much, right? That's the problem. And honestly, Deb was considering, do I actually like this guy at all? I just like his context. Do I just like his family? Because I come from this, yeah, Johnny's test fund over. I come from this kind of large, fun, exciting family. It's really been good to be a part of it. Some hard things, but mostly good. And Deb, coming from a really different family, she was thinking, do I just like his family or do I like the guy? You know what was good? It was good that Deb got to go through that dilemma before we were married, because she genuinely had the chance to opt out then and go, you know what, I actually don't like this guy. I thought he was nice, but I can see he's not that nice all the time, right? And it was good that she could see that early on. Yeah, you want to see what you're in for. You want to get a good glimpse of it. These days when people come and say, we're getting married, usually our response is, great. But now I'm thinking we should say this, why? That's grumpy old man talk, isn't it? But why? You want to have a good answer for that question though, don't you? Why? I mean, a bad answer would be the Hollywood answer. Oh, well, we're in love. And we want to spend our lives together. Bad answer. I'll give you an example of a good answer. All right, just an example. Why are you getting married? Because I'm personally ready to make a solemn vow and promise that I will never go back on, no matter how bad things get. This is for better, for worse, and I'm picturing worse. Rich or poor, and I'm picturing poor. Sickness in health, and I'm picturing serious sickness. You know, head injury, where her personality changes completely. And that's happened to a number of my friends. You've got to picture that, and you've got to say, I think it's got to be, you know, so there's partly the good answer, and then also say, and I'm confident that we will form a solid partnership or team that will be effective for the Lord. I'm confident we can do that. And we want to raise kids for the Lord and for the good of our society. See, I think a good answer has got less to do with you and how you're feeling and more to do with what you want to do to serve the Lord and serve the community that you're in. Now, if you asked me when I was 20-odd why, I wouldn't have given you that answer, you know? I think we just stumbled into this one and God's been gracious and helped us figure it out along the way, which is what most people do. But if you're young, get an idea as much as you can before you dive in. Two other categories of people that I think this teaching needs to apply to. And these are a little more serious. If you've been divorced, and if you've been divorced, then you've done well to hang in there tonight. You've done well to be. If you've been divorced, but you're hearing this teaching maybe for the first time and you're thinking, I think I divorced for the wrong reasons. I think I shouldn't have divorced. Or I think I should have fought harder and not given up so easily. Or if you're thinking, I've been divorced, but I was the one who blew it. I was the one who was unfaithful. I was the offender. And now I've remarried. If that's you, I think the most, you've got a choice here. You can hold this teaching away and go, nah. But can I plead with you? If I'm hearing Jesus' teaching correct here, can I plead with you? Here would be the best thing for you to do. You want to acknowledge mistakes you've made. You want to acknowledge fault. You want to acknowledge your own sin and own it. Because when you can own it and recognize it, then you can actually repent of it and then turn to God and ask for forgiveness for it and know the mercy and grace of God who forgives and restores and gives a fresh start. And I know some of you have done exactly that. We all make mistakes. Some of us will make mistakes that have bigger consequences that you're just going to need to live with, and that may be you. But know that God forgives. And if you've come to him and asked him for forgiveness, he will not hold your sin against you. He will not treat you as your sin deserves. How wonderful is that to hear? And we will aim to not treat you like that either. And so if you're a divorced person, you are welcome here. I think churches throughout history haven't been great at this. Many divorced people have simply heard from church, I failed, therefore I'm unacceptable and I'm unwelcome because churches are the place where only perfect people are allowed. No, it's the very opposite. If you think you're a perfect person, you're not allowed because you're missing the whole point. In fact, we don't want you to know. You want to consider your sin because this is a place for people who know their sin and have asked God for forgiveness and been redeemed. You're welcome here. You can belong here. You're not a second-class citizen in any way. You're a child of God. You're our brother and sister. Yeah? Second category, next category. If you're close to someone or you know someone who's going through a divorce at the moment, and again, Christians haven't been good at knowing what to do with this either. I think Christians have made a lot of mistakes. As I've chatted to people who have gone through divorce, here would be their advice to you if you're going to try to help them. Number one, keep in mind there are two sides to every story and reserve quick judgment about where all the fault lies. Just reserve that. Number two, stick by them and just walk with them. They're going through incredible personal pain, likely a sense of failure and dislocation. What they need for you is to just love them and walk alongside them in the midst of it. But here's the third one, and I was really glad to hear this one. Most people would say this, is love them, walk alongside them, but speak the truth to them. Don't hold off on speaking the truth of God's word and what he thinks. And if you're walking alongside a person who's not yet divorced, and there might be more that they could do to attempt to restore the marriage, then speak that truth to them in love. Do everything you can to help them get the help they need to possibly save the marriage. There's three things. Now, here's the final thing. And this is particularly for those of you who are married, and particularly for those of you who are really struggling in your marriage right now. No one might know it, but you know it. Fight. Fight with everything you've got and all the help you can get to keep your marriage together. Why? For your sake, because you made a solemn vow and promise that you would. For the kids' sake, if there are kids involved, and for God's sake. And here's the big one. Our marriages are meant to reflect God's marriage, which is the way he describes his relationship with us, his people. He has entered into a covenant relationship with us and has continued his loving commitment to us. And our marriages are meant to put on display his marriage. Ephesians chapter 5 makes that really clear, that one of the primary purposes of your marriage is to put on display and actually reflect something bigger, and that is the very character of God. So it's his character that's at stake and on display in your marriage, and particularly his character of covenant faithfulness, such that, and you've got to catch this, his character of covenant faithfulness, such that God does not divorce his people, even though we have been unfaithful to him. And that is the story of the Bible, the story of history, God's people failing to be faithful to him. I mean, we read from Hosea, the prophet who basically had to embody this whole message. God's people continually failed to worship him alone and went off after other gods. You see it right through Old Testament history, and we see it today that those of us who are following Jesus, we fail to follow him perfectly. We fail to stand with Jesus. We're ashamed of him. We fail to worship him alone, and we run off after the world and go off after so many other things, so many other lovers. And we give our time and our attention and our finances to so many other things. We are unfaithful to him, but he refuses to divorce us, his bride. What a wonderful husband we have. A husband who constantly calls us to return to him, and he continues to love us and keep his covenant towards us. He takes seriously his promise to us and extends to us incredible grace. God is fully committed to saving and enriching his marriage. And we, his people, are on the receiving end of his love. And that's expressed most clearly in Jesus. God refuses to divorce us, though we deserve it, though there's valid grounds. But instead, he takes the offense and the unfaithfulness upon himself in Jesus, who dies with our spiritual adulteries and deals with our sin, and God keeps his covenant promise with us. Put that on display in your marriage. That's what it's for. Let that be the driving force behind you giving every ounce of energy that you can muster and getting all the help that you can to keep it together, because God's character is on display in your marriage. Attempt to keep your covenant even when they fail. What an incredible opportunity we have to put on display God's covenant faithfulness by how we live. Let me pray.